Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:04 a.m. on Tuesday, March 28th, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, everybody please mute your phones. And at this meeting, we will have the introduction of Senate Bill 26, the appropriation limit and the permanent fund dividends and earnings by the governor. And we will continue hearing House Bill 115, the income tax permanent fund dividend credit, permanent fund income bill. And here to produce SB 26 is Commissioner Hoffbeck. And also we have here Emma Polkin from the Department of Law. And so, Commissioner and Ms. Polkin, if you would be so kind as to put yourselves on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
For the record, Emma Polkin with the Department of Law.
And for the presentation this morning, we're going to do it just a little different than I have in the past, only because we talked about SB 26 in the original governor's version already before the committee, and we actually did a bit of an introduction on 141 as well, and so the original version of 141. So you've kind of gone through a lot of the base slides, so I don't want to spend a lot of time going through the foundational slides again. So they're in the packet, but we're going to jump around. We're not going to sit and spend a lot of time on every one of the slides unless somebody wants to go back to one of them. I did change the front end a little bit and put an executive summary in the front end of the slide deck so we can just kind of walk through the conclusions first, and then we can go back and lay some of the foundation for some of those conclusions in the presentation. I think it is still important to take time to talk about what this is on slide three, the use of the permanent fund. Again, just to keep driving home the point that when the permanent fund was established, it was established for purposes of having money in the future for government expenditures. And this is the language from the ballot initiative, and the highlighted part says income from the fund would be deposited in the general fund of the state and be available to be appropriated for expenditure by the state. And so there was always this open-ended thought process that at some point in time this money would be used for state expenditures.
I'd like to note that Representative Kawasaki was also with us, and maybe if the committee, if we could hold questions until the end, I think, and then we'll do that. It's just
great.
For expediency. Thank you.
Slide four then is a recap of why we're actually talking about using permanent fund earnings now. Nobody came into this job or was elected into your positions with the idea of wanting to somehow pierce the earnings reserve and start spending the money. It just is a situation that we are in at this point in time in the fiscal life of the state. We have a $4.2 billion budget. We have about $1.6 billion in revenues, leaving with a $2.8 billion budget gap. The potential tools that have been discussed this year have been the motor fuels tax increase, the broad-based tax, the income tax that this body's been talking about, so oil and tax credit reform cuts, which the largest number that was actually put on the table was the $750 million over 3 years by the Senate. And then SB 26, which would generate $1.9 billion. So those are kind of the menu of items to get to a solution, that at least the menu of the items that are in play right now. And you just simply can't get to the 2.8 if the $1.9 billion in the using of the permanent fund earnings isn't part of the solution. The five key points that we used for evaluating any of these permanent fund restructurings were that it needed to be rules-based, it needed to be able to help stabilize the budget, it needed to protect the dividend, it needed to protect the permanent fund corpus, and it needed to maximize the use of the earnings reserve. And so those were the tests that we used for all of the plans that have been proposed. Slide six, then, is a review of how does SB 26 meet that test. And under status quo, you'll see here that status quo just simply doesn't meet any of the tests. SB 26 alone frankly, will meet the test for a period of time, but really at some point in time, your CBR is gone and you're tapping into the earnings reserve if SB 26 is the only piece that passes. You need SB 26 with a full fiscal plan in order for it to truly meet all of the requirements. Well, if it does have a full fiscal plan, that closes the gap entirely, and then you'll see that it does meet all 5 points of the test and is robust and durable over time.
I'd like to note that Representative Pruitt has joined us, and also I just want to mention that Representative Guerra is currently in a media availability, so he'll be here after a bit. So please proceed.
Slide 7 then is the kind of defines the size of what the remaining hole is after SB 26. You'll see that SB 26 is set at $4.1 billion. That is the appropriations cap within SB 26. So the budget would be $4.1 billion plus capital plus debt, because those two are outside the cap. You've got $1.6 billion in revenues. You've got, it allows for $1.9 billion in draws under SB 26. So you essentially at the after SB 26, you've got $0.6 billion, so $600 million hole that you still need to fill, plus whatever you spend for capital and debt. So that's the size of the hole that needs to be filled after SB 26. And then slide 8 graphically shows a time series on that particular the size of the deficit. And you'll see that it does close off, it does pinch off in 3 years, down to about $300 million, and then starts to grow again because the budget's held flat for 3 years before the budget's allowed to start growing again. And then once the budget starts growing, then you'll see that the deficit starts to grow again. So it does squeeze down in 2020 to about $300 million and then starts to grow again. Jumping then to slide 20, I just want to point out that the differences between the committee substitute for Senate Bill 26 that we're talking about today and the original SB 26 that we talked about earlier with this committee. And there's really three places that they're different. Under maximum POMV, about a third of the way down the page, the second bullet point, where it says beginning in FY 2021, 5% of the average value of the fund for the first five of the last 6 years. Under the original SB 26, it was 5.25% through the life of the plan. Under the committee substitute, it after 2021, it turns it down to a 5% draw from a 5.25% draw. Under the dividend calculation, is 25% of the percent of market value draw. Under the original SB 26, it was 20% plus 20% of the royalty revenue. So that's the difference. And then the overriding of the $1,000 dividend is extended one more year. So it's the $1,000 dividend for 3 years, whereas under the original, it was only 2 years. On the next page, slide 21, the only thing to point out here that's different from the prior slides, let me go through all three of these on this slide. We actually modeled it three different ways. We modeled it with a full fiscal plan. And by full fiscal plan, we mean that gap in revenues is closed somehow. It's either closed with reduced spending or new revenues. We haven't defined what it is. We're just saying if that is somehow closed, therefore there will not be additional draws against the permanent fund earnings, and that plan will be able to function as it's designed. Obviously, if there's a gap that's not closed at some point in time, there'll be a need to go and take additional draws out of the earnings reserve. And so what this is saying when it says full fiscal plan is that whatever the plan is, that gap was closed, and there won't be additional draws against the earnings reserve other than the plan itself. We then modeled the SB 26 with no other measures, meaning that $600 million remains in there and shrinks and grows over time as forecasted. And then we modeled SB 26 with the $750 million in cuts that the Senate had proposed as the part of their fiscal solution along with SB 26. The model does use a $4.1 billion appropriation limit plus capital and debt, And the capital and debt are assumed based on OMB forecasts within the modeling. And then slide 22 just graphically shows you really the difference in the budget assumptions between the three scenarios. The gold bar being SB 26 was $750 million in cuts. The green dash being the budget under the OMB's extended 10-year plan. And the blue dashed line is the SB 26 plus capital plus debt service. And so you see that SB 26 is essentially the spending and the appropriation cap within SB 26 essentially mirrors the forecasted budget that OMB had generated. There's not a significant difference between the two. Okay, then jumping to slide. Let's go to slide 27. Yes, and you've seen this slide before, and this is the POMV draw with the draw limit. And it shows how the and this is a price series, not a time series, but shows that at certain prices you begin to reduce the size of the draw from the permanent fund as oil and gas revenues begin to recover. The next two slides actually takes that and creates a time series to show how that would work over time. And this is just simply one series within thousands of runs that were done. And this is a fairly volatile series because we wanted to actually show in kind of extreme volatility the impact of having that draw. You see, it's volatile enough that it actually chops the top off a couple of our high revenue periods there. You see, this slide 28 is if there was no draw limit, if the POMV draw just occurred as revenues were available with no limit, and then on top of that was your royalty and production tax, and you can see the fairly volatile nature of the revenues that would be available for government expenditures. If we flip to slide 29, then and we tried to get these on one page so it'd be easier to look at, but they didn't fit. But you can kind of see how by having the draw limit in there, it tends to smooth out the volatility on the revenues. So it doesn't totally eliminate them. There's still years where you've got a little bit more revenue than you would, and some opportunities for capital programs and things, but you don't have the huge spikes because essentially the permanent fund turns off when it's not needed. And so the permanent fund being the gold bar, you can see how it shuts itself off when there's high oil and gas royalties and tax revenue. And ultimately, and under the same draw, if you go back from, if you look at the slide, compare 28 to 29, and this is, like I said, a high volatility, high revenues forecast. So these numbers don't match the midpoint numbers that we use elsewhere. But in a highly volatile situation, you'd be $5.6 million draw at the end of 2041 without a revenue, without the draw limit. If you introduce the draw limit, you've now preserved enough money within the earnings reserve that your draws actually could be $7 billion in that same time period, just because of turning off the use of the fund when you don't need it. So it does have an impact over time on available revenues as well. Let's jump then to slide 32. And 32 and 33 are the unrestricted general fund revenues available from the earnings reserve. And this is with the withdraw limit restrictions. And you'll see that with a full fiscal plan, the draw would grow from $1,867,000,000 in 2018 to $3,296,000,000 in 2041, or $1,954,000,000 real. So you're actually growing with inflation plus a little bit if it's a full fiscal plan involved. If on slide 33, you can see that it does not grow at the same rate with no fiscal plan. And in fact, your 2041 value is $2,489 nominal, or $2,489,000,000 nominal, the enforced 75 real, so you're actually losing some value. And then if you just flip back and forth between those two, you can just kind of see the line move back up and down. You can kind of see the impact of a full fiscal plan versus not in the revenues that are available over time. Slide 34 then just is a line graph to show the revenues, revenue comparison. This is total revenues including oil and gas and other revenues over time. The dotted line being status quo, the gold line being SB 26 with the cuts, SB 26 with full fiscal plan is the green dash, and then SB 26 with no fiscal plan is the blue. And you actually see how it, over time, without a fiscal plan, it degrades the amount of money available for government services. Jumping to slide 37 then, same slide series, except this is now for the dividend itself. And you see that with a full fiscal plan, we're starting with a $1,000 dividend in 2018. By 2041, that would be $1,606 dividend, about 941 real. So a little bit less real, about 6% less purchasing power in 2041 than now, but we're essentially growing close to inflation. The next slide is without a full fiscal plan. You see a degradation in the dividend as well, where it's now $1,277 nominal, $749 real in 2041. And again, you can flip the back and forth between the slides and kind of see the net effect on the reducing size of dividend if the full fiscal plan is not in place. Slide 39 is the dividend, again, same slide line graph with the status quo, SB 26 with cuts, SB 26 with a full fiscal plan. And you can see again, the cuts essentially equate to a full fiscal plan if you could make $750 million in cuts. So that tends to justify why the Senate was looking at that level of cuts in there. It's not whether you can achieve $750 million in cuts is another story altogether. But it can be a balance of cuts or revenues. But it essentially would equate to a fiscal plan. The dotted line is status quo. And you see that after 2024, it just falls off the table. At that point in time, you've depleted your CBR, and you've depleted excess revenues within your earnings reserve under status quo, and now you're starting to have to choose whether you pay a dividend or pay your bills. And although this shows kind of a tapering off to 2028, the reality is it probably would fall right off the table in 2024 because you would have to be, again, deciding whether you could pay your bills or not. And then the other two lines, you can see the degradation of the dividend over time without a full fiscal plan. Slide 43 is the same set of slides now for the full fund size, so the full size of the permanent fund over time. So in 2000, we're starting with a fund size right now of about $54 billion. So under the full fiscal plan, that would grow to $111 billion nominal by 2041, or about $65 billion real. So you're actually seeing real growth in the size of the fund under the full fiscal plan, and the earnings reserve failure rate being if there was ever a point in time anywhere in the time series where there would not be enough money to pay the dividend and pay for the government services, essentially the earnings reserve goes to zero. It would be less than 1% chance of it ever going to zero. So it's almost close to a slam dunk, no issues as you can get if it's implemented with a full fiscal plan. The next slide 44, is the same without a full fiscal plan. You'll see that now the nominal value is $78 billion or $46 billion real. So you've actually lost real value within the fund if you implement it without a full fiscal plan. And the earnings reserve failure rate goes to 46%. Real chance of failure if all you have is 26 with no other measures being taken. Slide 45 is again the line graph showing the various representations of the plans. And on this one, it's the first one you really start seeing a separation between just cuts and a full fiscal plan. You'll see that a full fiscal plan that would include revenues, you actually see some revenue growth over time, and in the out years you actually see a little bit larger fund size. And the rest of these are conclusion slides that are similar to the executive summary that was in place at the top. So with that, I'd open it up for questions.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Before we open it up for questions, I just want to let folks know that we will have Mr. David Teal up here next on modeling, and then Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Mike Navarro will also be up to do a presentation. So with that, does the committee have any questions for Commissioner Hoffbeck? Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So, a couple questions back closer to the beginning. Sorry, I'm going to take a second to get back to it. Just because it's a long presentation. Give me a second. I know Paul had a question. Go ahead and ask.
Representative.
So I can get back to what I need.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that was here looking at the revenue limit, we had that modeled with 115. We had some charts that were looking at the 2026 fund size and 2041, and then the 2026 dividend and 2041, and then the ERA failure rate. So I don't see those in your presentation. Do you have that same chart for SB 26? I mean, you talked about a 46% failure rate. So with that alone, can you provide those to us just so we have them for comparisons?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, we don't have them, but we can certainly compile them and as well. So.
Okay, thank you. Okay. And Mr. Chairman?
Sure. Follow-up?
Another question I had on the looking at the difference between cuts and full revenue, the full plan through revenue. Is there anything in here that associates the real economy as what happens with $750 million in cuts taken out with the job loss, with the downgrading or slowing down of the economy in that scenario versus a revenue scenario? Is that included anywhere in this?
To the chair, Co-Chair Seaton. No, this model doesn't incorporate that feedback loop as far as the economy is concerned. Obviously, there's been several people have come here and presented on the various impacts of the choices being made. But this one is largely a numbers formula here without the feedback on the impact of the various choices that might be made.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I'm ready. Thank you. A couple questions that I have. One is trying to make sure I understand. We've got one change on here that is the royalty reduction that goes into there, the going from the 50% to the 25% on the new oil stuff. Is that I guess my question is the governor okay with that? I mean, what is the thought process of if we have additional oil coming through in a few years, should we maintain the reduced level of royalty money that goes into the permanent fund and go ahead and utilize it through the general fund? What is your thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. The idea here is that once these put in place, that short of something just really dramatic occurring, that would be a quantum shift in revenues to the government, that we would anticipate that this is how it would stay. That there's other methods with the feedback loop to put money back into the corpus of the fund. Essentially the choice was made years ago when we had flush revenues that put more into the corpus of the fund by that larger royalty deposit. But we're not there anymore, and so we've gone back to what the constitutional mandate was, the original plan within the Constitution. I expect that's where we would anticipate it would stay.
Okay, so follow-up.
Follow-up.
So, I'm trying to take even a 20, 30-year look here. Mm-hmm. You know, 20 years ago, we didn't, we were kind of living within our enjoyment of the lifestyle then, and which had its booms and busts. But now, of course, we're in the situation where there's the reduced throughput. If we were to go back to a higher level of throughput, you know, that would be in the same manner that this last, you know, the increase eventually came down. You know, I would expect it would come down. I mean, at a certain point in time, we've decided, maximize the use of the permanent fund earnings. I guess it's the policy call of deciding that we're going to go ahead and just flat out say we're going to use the permanent fund to the max. We're going to use all the money that we receive separately in the general fund. We don't account for the fact that this is kind of like it. Like, we've just hit retirement. And we are on the we're never going to gain any more, even though there's a potential. We're never going to gain any more into that savings, even though there's the potential that we could have additional oil. I mean, how do we think about that time frame where maybe there is that uptick? And I think we're all kind of positive that there could be, at least throughput-wise, and don't want to get into price discussion. Should we come back and rethink it at that point in time if we're going to go ahead and make this policy call now? I mean, I know you said it should be durable, but at the same time, I don't want to find ourselves 20 years from now, which I expect to still be in Alaska and, you know, have my kids, having to deal with the results of the fact that 5 years from now we had more oil going through the pipeline, but we didn't plan on saving it for that next generation that was coming behind.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, because of the way that this system shuts off the earnings reserve draw when oil prices recover, it essentially automatically flips that revenue back into the corpus of the fund, because you would build then your earnings reserve to four times the draw, and then the appropriations would go back into the corpus of the fund. So I think the bigger risk here would be that in high revenue years, there would be a temptation to harvest some of that additional revenue and not follow the plan, and I think that's where you'd get into not saving for the future. I would caution that looking at where we would change this in a high revenue year would lead to maybe some decisions that maybe would not meet the long-term goals of durability. And so I'm hesitant to open the door to that. But certainly if there's a quantum shift, say you've started running down, moving west and you're finding oil field after oil field after oil field, or Anwar opens up and you've got another Kuparuk or Prudhoe Bay, and then you're looking at a quantum shift, and it might be worth revisiting. But if you just get a 2 to 3 year spike in revenues, I would hesitate to want to start changing the plan at that for those kind of occasions.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, I totally understand a couple year spike. Of course, we tend to plan here based on the here and now, not on the long term. And that's just kind of been the life cycle of Alaska. It's part of being a new state, I guess you'd say. There's others. We don't have the experience to draw from that goes back, in some cases, many, many years, hundreds of years in some cases. And so we've lived like teenagers might live. And so I'm trying to be very cautious about how we think about that. Now, but I do want to add one more question, just in that vein of that thought process, which is the four times draw. One thing that I just want to make sure I understand. So what would you expect, because the ERA is up there close to $11 billion this year, when would you expect that draw would start taking place in the next couple of years? At what time? And what would you expect, and you may not have the exact numbers, I'm okay with the estimates, would be moved into the corpus in the next few years? Are you able to give an idea? I understand those can be specific, but
through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's a hard thing to pin down because of the life cycle modeling with the plan and this, you know, assumptions of good years and bad years. If we have a couple more years like we've had this year, we could easily hit the 4x draw because of just returns within the permanent fund. If we see PICA come on, you know, in the early 20s, and it comes on at 200,000 barrels a day or something with a reasonable oil price, we could see where we could essentially turn off the earnings reserve draw and even without real good returns trip the 4x draw because we just simply are taking money out of that account. So that's hard to say. I mean, because we're actually starting with a lot higher earnings reserve than we anticipated because of this year's good returns, we could trip it in a year or two, but it could be 10 years before we trip it. Just kind of depends how things play out.
Yeah, well, and one last follow-up, and I appreciate the allowing for the questions. So I guess the last question that I'll have, and of course we have in front of us just, you know, one of the modeling, but this modeling, that's just 26, doesn't include what I think is the goal of the Senate, which is the $750 million cuts in it. So I can respect that there's a piece that's missing of what their plan is. But if we just went with their plan without those cuts and it remained flat, which is what is on here, the value of the fund in 10 years is 101%, the buying power of the fund. I guess my question is from the administration's perspective, I think there's three goals that were, there's three options in how to go forward with the fiscal plan. And I don't think in any conversation from any committee there has been an answer in what are the priorities and what are the orders of those. And that would be either do we preserve the fund, largest or smallest dividends possible, or make sure that there's as much money for government. And so I guess the question that I would have is realizing that this without those cuts would be basically a status quo. So therefore it's I think the answer is less about preserving the fund. We might even shift more to the priority in order would start with make sure that government is funded, and then secondarily would probably be the fund, and then third would be make sure that there's a permanent fund. What is the goal from the administration? What stands out as the first thing, the most important of those three concepts as we address this fiscal plan?
For the chair representative, that's a good question. I don't know that there's a hierarchy, but there was a consideration of all of them in putting this particular plan together. The only reason we're here is because we need money for funding government services. We wouldn't even be having this discussion. So obviously that's a very important component. Traveling around the state and talking to people about the plan, it became very clear that at some level we had to preserve a dividend. Not necessarily at the historic levels, but at some level there had to be a dividend. So that had to be a piece of the plan. And obviously when you balanced how much you could use for government services and how much you could pay for a dividend, you couldn't exceed the amount that the fund could bear as far as how much it could make available. And so the I guess if the hierarchy is there, the first thing we did was figure out how much money we could actually draw out of the fund on an annual basis and still maintain the real value of the fund over time. And then the other two are probably just a balancing act. How much we go to dividend, how much is government services.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's see, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just to compare this plan, so on page four, where we're talking about the current gap, expecting that we're going to still spend $4.2 billion in this budget. The first would be between this and 115 would be the draw, $4 billion draw from the permanent fund earnings reserve by HB 115 compared to this, I'm assuming, would be a $1.9 billion by this bill. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this would be a $1.9 billion draw in FY18. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So then our next part is looking at the gap that would leave would be the difference between some type of broad-based tax, the income tax that happens to be in 115, or the proposed decrease in governmental services of the $750 million.
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, or it could be a combination of cuts and taxes. Certainly the income tax by itself closes substantially the entire deficit, although depending upon where it's calibrated, it could still leave $100 or $200 million to deal with. But you can also get there with a series of cuts and other pieces as well. I mean, it just needs to total up to that additional, you know, between $600 and $900 million in the hole that you have. So if you made a few hundred million in cuts and came up with, you know, $400 or $500 million in new revenues, you could get there that way as well. So,
and follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So people don't like to use the word cuts, and I understand that, because we could actually be smarter and more efficient in the way that we provide government. We had a talk here a few weeks ago about approximately $1.2 billion going to municipalities and grants, all different kinds of forms, mm-hmm. Which doesn't really have a lot to do with the employees we currently have. The administration already talked about shared services and the savings that we'll have, much less the two bills that we passed last year. So, you know, your Department of Revenue, so as we look at the possibility of taxes versus being and having a smarter government or taking as much out of the PFD as we have, isn't there really a hierarchy of which one has more impact on not just the individuals but the economy? I mean, they're all not level when it comes to how much impact we may have on our residents.
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, they all have an impact. Every decision we make has an impact on the economy. And so the true measure is what's the relative difference between the impacts, because we can't avoid the impacts. And we're facing that. I mean, we're going to have to make some decisions that are going to have some impacts. And so it really is the relative difference between the choices we make, not the fact that we can avoid an impact altogether. The only one that doesn't have an impact in the short term is spending savings. But if we spend our savings, eventually we run headlong into the fact that we're worse off than we are now, because now we're still facing the same issues and we have no buffer on how to slowly move into a solution. So I guess I can't give you a specific answer except to just caution, you know, look at the relative difference between impacts. Don't look at the total impact of any decision, because we're going to have to face some of those impacts no matter what we decide.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
I don't think there's anybody around the table that thinks status quo or just taking out of our savings account works. Even though we were taking money out of our savings accounts, it wasn't like we were sitting back at not making changes and trying to make government more efficient in what it does. But I think the end goal for everybody here, and that's where you get the difference of opinion, is how can we stop the economy from turning down more than it is right now? At the same time, what are exactly essential government services? But I think it's important for us to understand, of these different choices that we have, which ones have the most impact on the residents of the state. So, but I'm glad we're not using the status quo as much, because I think, you know, everybody is way beyond that point. The question is, how do we keep the economy going in the best way that we can?
Just if I could make one comment on that, I think that points to the reason that we have to get to a full fiscal solution, because the economy is not going to grow because of government spending, because we don't have money that we can put into the economy, which means we have to create an environment where the private sector will invest. And in order to get the private sector to invest, they need to know what the solution is, because they can't have the uncertainty of what happens next. They need to know what happens next.
Thank you. I'd like to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Guerra, who is in another meeting. And with that, Representative Ortiz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Randy, I want to make sure I have this correct. On this modeling that we're looking at for Senate Bill 26, does it include, as a part of the model, does it include the 1.2 revenue, would we come in at 1.2 billion in revenue and oil revenue, that there's that dollar for dollar savings? Is that included in this model?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, that's included in the model.
Okay. And then have we, as it just slipped my attention, or is there, when we talk about the cut option of getting to $750 million in 3 years in cuts, have we seen any documents as to where those cuts might come from? In other words, in order for us to model how that's going to impact the economy, I think we need to know specifically where those cuts are going to are going to come from. Is that out there somewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, no. I mean, the cuts have not been specified, although I think the Senate has indicated where they intend to make the cuts, which is in education, transportation, university, and health and social services. So that apparently is where they're focusing on their cuts. We did run scenarios with cuts that we thought were more, you know, were broad-based and had some ideas of what that would look like. And we presented some of those to this committee before, where we looked at how much of that actually ends up being passed down to local communities. So there's a lot of way to make the cuts. None of them are without their own collateral damage. So.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, is there any consensus out there amongst the administration, amongst ICER, amongst any group of people that says which pathway we follow would have the least amount of impact on the economy? It's all going to impact the economy. You know, if I start paying a personal income tax, that's less money that I have to spend in the economy. I understand that. My question is there a consensus out there that following the cut model versus the added revenue model, which one has the least impact on the economy? Is there any study out there on that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think ICER and some of the other economists have pontificated on their opinion on the relative impacts of the choices. So there's no one set model out there where you can start turning knobs and see what happens, but I think you've had several people that have testified on where they think the biggest impacts would be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions of the committee? Got two questions, Representative Guerra and then Seaton.
Thank you. I'm sorry for joining late. Commissioner Hoffbeck, the Senate plan standing on its own, SB
126?
26. Okay. 26. As legislative finance has modeled it, if we had a flat budget after this year, it shows a deficit continuing for many, many years into the future if that's the only plan that gets passed. What's the administration's position on whether that would be a success for this session to only pass a permanent fund bill?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the administration has said that we need a full fiscal plan. And SB 26, although we feel is a very good structure for using the earnings of the permanent fund, that it's robust and it's durable and it maximizes the draw, doesn't get us to the finish line. We need more pieces.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I wanted to correct a statement that was made on House Bill 115. The FY18 draw is the same as this, 5.25% for FY18. But I wanted to ask you about relations of a kind of a gross tax and a net profit tax. Are cuts basically coming upfront out of the economy where a income tax is based on profits and after money has been generated? And does that make a difference in the reaction of industry? I mean, the oil companies have testified to us repeatedly that they wanted a net profits tax because it was after they made money and it adjusted that way. And but I'm not hearing that differential talked about between an upfront cut for the fiscal plan versus a net profits tax or income tax.
To the chair, Co-Chair Seaton, I guess it really depends upon what you believe the use of the profits would be within a business setting. How much would be harvested and be money that would be spent in the economy? How much of the profits would be reinvested in the business? And so if you're looking at money that would just simply be harvested and the owners of the business would spend it, It really doesn't make that much difference whether the government's spending it or the owner's spending it as far as its total impact. If it's money that would be reinvested in the business and grow the business, then it could have an impact on economic growth over time. A lot of it just depends upon, you know, what your assumptions are as far as the ultimate use of those profits would be. Again, on the growth side, on the cuts, it depends where you cut. You know, if you cut something that just simply isn't needed, then it probably has very little impact on the economy. If you're cutting programs that have a need behind them and the need doesn't go away, they need to be absorbed someplace else. And so you don't really save much with the cut. You just pass the cut on to somebody else, and the money has to be spent someplace else. And so you don't really achieve the goal with the cut. So it's a complex equation on what the right thing to do is.
Follow up?
Yeah. Another question. Would you go to slide 28 and 29 again? One of the things that we've been looking at is trying to figure out on the draw limit. Would you explain a little in more detail, I guess, on where we are at, on that whole slide and the different structures?
Sure. So let's look at slide 28 and just the various pieces of the slide. The dark green bar at the bottom is our other existing revenues. Those are taxes and fees that we currently have in place, and that's a fairly stable set of revenues. The light green bar is other new UGF revenues, which is whatever might be done to close the fiscal gap. Then the gold bar is the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. And the light blue being royalties and the dark blue being taxes. And so those are all of your revenue sources that you're looking at that you'd have available for funding government services and for funding a dividend. And of course, there's a tremendous amount of volatility on the oil and gas revenues. Some of the volatility is gone in the permanent fund, even though investment earnings could be volatile, but because using that five-year average, we tend to take a substantial amount of the volatility out of it. That's why the gold bar doesn't bounce around as much as the blue bars do in this first graph. So what you're saying when you put in the draw limit, you're saying that you're going to absorb the volatility in oil price, high oil prices, by reducing the draw from the permanent fund. So you're essentially putting the volatility into your permanent fund draw and on the downside. So that you don't increase your draw at low oil prices, but you do decrease it at high oil prices. And so you see that now, instead of all of the volatility being in that dark blue bar at the top, and you see that on the second page, the volatility now resides in the gold in your permanent fund draw, and you turn the permanent fund off in order to offset high oil price years. Or production years, and dramatically smooth the revenues available for government services. So, does that answer your question?
Representative Seaton?
Thank you. It does, except I'm a little curious about the other UGF revenues.
Yes.
Because we've equated $750 million in cuts with revenues to get a plan, but when we have revenues, that's an annual revenue that is coming in, and so if we're equating cuts to that, does that mean that we are saying that those are going to have to be recurring cuts also to equivalent with the revenue that's annually coming in to get a full fiscal plan?
Yeah. Through the chair, co-chair Seaton, this one assumed that the answer would be a revenue package to get to the final solution. This particular example, based on reduced expenditures, then you would have just seen everything shift down. That green bar would go away or be much smaller, but your total budget would be smaller. Your starting point would be smaller. So this one assumes that it's solved with revenues, but you could do the same thing with expenditures. The chart would just look, that green bar would just be a little thinner, and the total starting point would be lower than the 4.2. So,
Representative C.
And on the 18-19 on the new revenues, is that because there's a ramp-up time before, I mean, no matter what we do today, there's a regulation package and other things that have to take place for many of these items before they would generate their full amount of revenue.
Yeah. So the chair, Co-Chair Seaton, that's correct. And Emma reminded me that this particular chart was based on 115. And so this one, that's why that green bar is an income tax on this particular chart. So
thank you. I was trying to figure it out.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead. Thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. Let's go ahead and move on to Leg Finance and Mr. David Teal. So appreciate your presentation. And with that, Mr. David Teal. Okay. We're going to do a brief at ease just to get set up here. I'd like to, we're going to have Mr. David Teal, Legislative Fiscal Analyst, walk us through the committee, walk the committee through some modeling on SB 26. And Mr. Teal, if you could go and proceed with your presentation, put yourself on the record.
David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. And I don't really have a presentation per se. It's just that we left off yesterday with a few perhaps unanswered questions about SB 26 versus HB 115. So if there are questions, I can try to address them.
Questions of the committee? Representative Wilson?
You ready? Okay.
I might agree with this.
So in the top left corner, and I know it's not in the bill, and that's probably what makes all this difficult, because we have a bill, but then we also have, when the bill came forward, of decreases in government of approximately $750,000 as being part of the plan for the next 3 years. How do you model that using the top part of showing what that would look like for the next 3 years? And then I'm assuming it would be with a not a billion-dollar increase for the next, you know, 8 years, but 1% or whatever we would be looking at for inflation-proofing at this point.
Through the chair, this model is fairly simplistic. We can enter a negative 750 here, and that's just a target cut. It's going to move your budget down by $750 million in each year. And, of course, what that does is make all your reserves grow. Now, I don't know if this is... So, again, taking away that cut...
Oh, wait, can you leave it there for a minute?
Sure.
And question, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
So... As the line is now going up, what percent each year are we utilizing, you know, for that increase? I mean, are we using inflation? Or are we using whatever number looks good? I mean, how do you figure, you know, what the increase is then? Because the 10-year plan, we've tried that here, and the 10-year plan, really, nobody abides by it. So, but there's got to be a percent increase versus flat.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this isn't the old 10-year plans that you saw that basically said, here's the past, we've gone up by 3, 4, 5, 6, 7% a year, and suddenly from here on it's flat. This 10-year plan is actually OMB's expectations. Those expectations were basically a flat budget for 2 years, 18, 19, and then growing with inflation, which is a 2.25% growth rate. That number comes from the permanent funds rate of inflation.
So follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So now taking that 750 of being more efficient government, how does that then compare to if we don't make government more efficient at a $750 million next 3 years, adding an income tax instead and being not as efficient?
What you have now, it's hard to see the movement here, but you've got 750. Okay, it would be what you're asking, I think, is the equivalent of saying, give us an income tax.
Well, don't give us, but what if you
And take away So a $750 million income tax versus a $750 million reduction gives you charts that look very similar.
And follow up?
Follow up.
When did the income tax get to $750 million? I thought we were only at this point to 668. Did it increase again overnight? The current income tax that we're talking about.
Through the chair, the current income tax is roughly the $700 million here. It shows new revenue from income tax, 687. Varies by year, but basically, in round numbers, we just say a $700 $1 million tax versus $750. $50 million seems like a lot of money, but it doesn't really show up that much in these charts. So either way, you're getting reserves that are fairly steady here. In other words, if I, again, take away the income tax and then do a negative 700, just to make it more similar, gives you roughly the same look on that chart.
Perfect. So I just wanted to see what, you know, our two choices were, and that shows it very well. Thank you.
Okay, we've got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have answered it already, but I want to get it squared away. But the chart on the top left includes inflation and size of the government and the budget, that 2.5%. That's already built into that. And then you have the $700 million reductions out of was SB 26. That's already built into that graph.
It's through the chair. It's built into it. If you put something here that assumes cuts, if you don't do that, then it's not built in. It's not part of the model. It's an option you choose.
Okay. If I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, I mean, I consider the $700 million cuts self-inflicted wounds. But I'm just wondering, what relation does that have with the size of the budget as far as, and I know we've all asked this question, and it's a more interactive question on the economy, but when you're cutting 13,000 jobs out of the economy, what effect does that have on the size of the government, whether it's K-12 or the payout on the permanent fund? Is that part of what's in here? Or is that, this is just numbers?
Through the chair, it's numbers. As Commissioner Hoffbeck said, it's really difficult to go the next step and say, you know, you give me a number for a cut, what does that mean? The easiest cuts for state government to take are simply transferring costs to municipalities. Mm-hmm. Okay. Those look like budget cuts to this model, but if you ask local citizens, they would say, what cut? I now, you know, you cut state government and filled your fiscal gap, but you transferred costs onto municipalities, which then had to raise taxes. They would be paying taxes whether they go to the local government, or you could continue to provide the same level of state services and tax them the amount of money that you shifted to municipalities. So there's no easy answer to that. It's as the commissioner said, it's a complex interaction of government expenditures, government services, state and local services, and at which level of government people pay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. We've got a question from Representative Guerra and then Seaton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this, David. I mean, we've been through the charts a number of times. I'll just note, though, let me just ask you. I think I know how I feel, but I mean, inflation, you know, showing a chart that goes up with inflation is nice, but there are a lot of costs in state government that go up higher than inflation. You know, we have the highest medical costs in the country, the highest often annual increase in medical costs, and our medical costs tend to go up higher than inflation. So if you built a budget that sort of just did this pretend, oh, everything will stick with inflation, you've got to find cuts to make up for those areas that go up faster than inflation, like Medicaid recently, for example, correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. I mean, inflation hits all costs. usually personal services is where we think of it if you have cost of living increases. That's the biggest driver for the cost, for the inflation in state government. Right now, the contracts have no cost of living increase, so that I would not expect government cost to go up by the rate of inflation. But again, that's why OMB's 10-year plan shows them current contracts are basically mostly three-year items, and that when those contracts are renegotiated, inflation might go back in. That's an what appears to me to be an expectation in that 10-year plan. If you do not keep pace with inflation, then yes, it's the equivalent to a real reduction in costs or expenditures.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have SB 26 up. Would you go ahead and put the $750 million in for the plan there? And can you tell us what the size of the permanent fund is and on the end, what is it, 2026?
Through the chair, you can see the permanent fund is roughly $70 billion. 67.5.
It's 67.5. Okay. And that's 1%. 101. Does that mean it's 1% above inflation, or 1%, or it's grown 1% and inflation is growing 2.25%?
Through the chair, it means that the permanent fund is 1% above the FY18 value, inflated by 2.25% to FY26. In other words, it is keeping pace with inflation and slightly better than keeping pace.
Okay, thank you. And I see the dividends up there are at $1,000 or just dipped below for a couple of years. Can you now go to SB 1 or HB 115 with the income tax and take out the $750 million in cuts?
So in this scenario, you see higher dividends going up to roughly $1,400. Instead of the $1,000. The permanent fund is at roughly the same level.
What was that number? 68?
69. So $2 billion higher. So it is doing better than keeping pace with inflation. It's 103% instead of 101. But remember, these numbers, as you get further out, that difference is not something that I would say you should count on. It's margin of error. They're essentially very similar numbers.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you.
Representative Wilson?
Okay, so back to the graph where the permanent fund and how much it is. What you don't know, because unlike, and I'm not advocating for either bill, but if I'm going to pay an income tax now, I might get a check for $1,400, but I'm going to be paying some of that money back, if not all of it, based on what my tax bracket is. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
So I just want to make sure when people are looking at this is not apples to apples to $1,400 to $1,000, because one has no income tax and the other one does. So it depends upon if I'm single or married, or if I have dependents, or and my tax bracket could be that every bit of that $1,400 has been completely wiped out because of what kind of income tax I would have to pay. So just want to make sure the public realizes you got to add in the chart that's out there now to find out how much money you are going to now have to give back of that $1,400 and possibly all the way down to zero.
Representative Guttenberg.
Yeah, I just want to comment to that on what Mr. Thiel said earlier. If you add in the $750 million cuts, you're also transferring, you're either cutting teachers or you're transferring costs down to the local communities where you'll be paying the bill regardless, depending upon what's done. $750 million in cuts, teachers, health care, which are certainly the health care don't go away. They're just moved around into other places. So if we want to get into real apples to apples, you have to deal with those issues. Thank you.
Representative Pruitt and then Garrett.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to make – so one of the things that I noticed when I look at the SB 26 and it's different in the 115 is actually and I'm trying to make sure I read it right. When in 26 does the draws from the permanent fund start? Of course, the 115 and the current budget have the 1.6 that comes out from FY17, and then there's the FY18 has another number. Is the same amount come out in 26? It just comes out in 18, and my question along with that is there a difference in terms of the effect that it has on the permanent fund and its ability to earn with which year those amounts would come out? If they are the same, they're just in two different fiscal years.
Through the chair, the permanent fund balance would be roughly the same under either bill, as you've seen, and that's because the payout is the same. We're assuming the same level of earning, 6.95%, under any bill you choose. The payout from the plans takes 5.25% for the first couple years. 1 year difference, I think SB 26 takes it for 3 years, HB 115 takes it for two. After that, it's 5%. So again, the total payout from the permanent fund is identical, leaving you with an identical end balance, or close to it.
Is there a follow-up on that?
Follow-up?
So I guess, does 26 start that process, though, in 18? Because I think if I recall, the intent with the budget, and I believe the intent with 115, I don't know if it's 115 is the intent, but I know at least in the current budget that we had passed, basically we assumed as if this had passed last year. So FY17 will see essentially the same draw that it would have, or if 115 had been in effect last year. But I don't think that 26 does that. And that's kind of, that's a 1.6 billion difference in the earning potential, the 9% basically that potentially, or whatever it may be this year, from that. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Through the chair, that's the approximately $2 billion difference you're seeing in the ending fund balance. It's because SB 115 does take the $1.7 billion in 17 from the permanent fund. Under SB 26, there is no scheduled FY17 payout. So that's the money that stays in the permanent fund and gives you that higher end balance. But you also are looking at moving money from the earnings reserve account. We know this, that the four times rule transfers money from the earnings reserve account into the corpus. So that draw in FY17 would put you under the four times limit. And just to make it simple, just assume that the payout's roughly $2.5 billion. That means any balance over $10 billion in the ERA would be transferred from the earnings reserve account to the corpus. So under 115, that transfer to corpus would not occur. Under SB 26, I think it's likely that you would have a transfer in 18, and that money would then no longer be available to draw. It would be in the permanent fund. But, of course, the market value, whether it's in the permanent fund or earnings reserve, doesn't change. Therefore, the payout, same percentage payout, doesn't change. So it's just a question of whether you want the money in the earnings reserve account or the corpus.
As well as, and just follow up, as appreciate that, as well as there'd also be a difference in terms of whether there was a certain amount, what the size of the CBR would be as well, right? Because that correlation, that kind of flip from being in one to another.
Correct. Through the chair, given a level of deficit, we're either going to fill that deficit with an income tax, partially fill it, but what you're really talking about here is how much of your remaining deficit comes from the earnings reserve account, because if it doesn't fill the deficit, then you're going to be taking money from the CBR to fill that deficit. So as legislators, you have a choice. The money can be removed from the CBR, from the earnings reserve account, or held out of the corpus. In other words, remain. You have your choice of transferring money to corpus or not.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Guerra?
No. Thanks.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we've got another presentation here. Thank you, Mr. Thiel. Mr. Mike Navarre, if you want to go ahead and come up and get set up here. And so we'll be returning to HB 115, and Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Mike Navarre will have a PowerPoint presentation. He's also a member of the Conference of Mayors, and his presentation is titled Alaska's Economy, Why We Need a Comprehensive Fiscal Plan for Alaska, and Why Broad-Based Taxes Are Being Considered. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease while we do the transition. Back on record, I see we also have Larry Persley with us. If you could both just put your names and affiliation on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Foster, members of the committee. My name is Mike Navarre, Mayor of the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Title of my slideshow is Alaska's Economy. What I'm trying and hoping to do is broaden the debate a little bit. This is part of a presentation I'm giving in town hall meetings in my communities, Kenai Soldotna on Saturday, and then next week in Homer and in Seward, in order to try to help, I guess, with the discussion that's taking place. With me is Larry Persley. He's the Chief of Staff for my office at the Kenai Peninsula Borough. I was only able to hire him because he wanted to work on state fiscal issues. I hired him as an oil and gas advisor, and then transitioned him to chief of staff when I lost my chief of staff to the city of Kenai. I have a degree, a Bachelor of Arts in Government with a minor in economics. I say that because it's relevant, but also because I'd like to make the point that the best education I ever got was when I sat where you're sitting in the Alaska legislature. As you know, you get access to a lot of information and expertise, consultants, and are inundated with information that you have to digest as part of your job. I know you take that job seriously. I appreciate the job that you do. So I'm from local government, and I am here to help. The You all know what the problem is, $2.8 billion annual deficit, no easy answers, budget cuts, taxes, whatever sorts of taxes, permit fund earnings, or economic development have all been talked about as ways to resolve it. For the various options, budget cuts are way easier said than done for a lot of reasons, in part because of how we prioritize in our state spending, philosophical differences and rhetoric that exacerbates the differences, and quite honestly a lot of misunderstanding among the public about what government is and what government does and the benefits that we get from the contributions we make towards the cost of that. And everyone worries about economic impacts. You've all seen this slide before. It just shows where the top three general fund spending components are, and you know, I didn't adjust it for oil tax credits. I know there's been some adjustments made, but the reason I put this up here is to show why budget cuts are so much more difficult than people assume. And the big part is that we have always prioritized education. That's something that I think that we should do. It's always a priority. And then when you talk about health and social services, Medicaid, and we talk about the impacts to dividend cuts, keep in mind that some of the spending categories that we have in budget also directly affect those who are of lower income in our state. With respect to taxes, again, it's much easier said than done because we have not had to really pay taxes at the state level for a long period of time. It takes time to adopt the regulations and implement taxes. There's philosophical differences about taxation and a lot of heated rhetoric, and everyone worries again about the economic impacts. And with respect to this, you know, whether or not you're talking about oil taxes, oil tax credits, income tax versus sales tax, or even a statewide property tax, I will talk about which ones I prefer if you'd like. You've also, I think, all seen this slide. It just shows where Alaskans are in terms of broad-based taxes compared to other states. That in and of itself is not a good reason to implement taxes. With respect to oil and gas taxes, what's different today? I know that you've all seen this slide. We peaked in our production in this state in 1988. We've been trending downward ever since. Further production, which we could maybe turn this around somewhat, but in order to get further production, it requires significant capital investment. In order to have capital investment, you need a reasonably stable tax environment. This is a slide that I borrowed from a presentation I saw from ConocoPhillips, and I know that it really was interesting to me when I saw it, and the reason I borrowed it is that what's changed from 2005 in terms of what was projected. In 2005, U.S. oil production was expected to go down. Natural gas imports were expected to go way up, and total net energy imports was supposed to go way up. And as you all know, that's changed. It's changed in part because of fracking in the lower 48 in both the Bakken, Permian Basin, Marcellus, and Eagle Ford in Texas. The paradigm has really shifted in oil and gas development. That's why the price has gone down, is because the U.S. is now at or near the top in terms of oil production in the world. And we have to compete with these areas now in order to get the capital investment in Alaska that's necessary in order to make sure that we can have production well into the future. The other option is permanent fund earnings and public perceptions and anger over the changes, political consequences of any changes, impact to permanent fund growth, and we're already seeing that happening because the legislature made a conscious decision, the right one, I think, to not inflation-proof and to keep those funds in the earnings reserve in order to make sure that we had some budget reserves in order to plan for and accommodate fixing the fiscal situation. It will impact permanent fund dividends, and there's a constant concern there about the economic impacts and where those hit. There's also a lot, I put this slide in here because the permanent fund dividend is very popular, but there's a lot of misunderstanding about the permanent fund itself, how it got there, and you know, and when I do presentations, I talk about how the money got there, because a lot of them think it's all constitutionally dedicated, but the reality is that only 40% of it came from oil and gas and royalty payments that went into the fund that are constitutionally dedicated. 40% came from legislative action to inflation-proof the fund as part of of an investment into the future, and 20% came from legislative transfers of surplus oil dollars when we had excess revenues. It wasn't all just spent. Some of it was, in fact, put into the permanent fund. You will hear, and I'm sure have already heard a lot about what folks who were here at the time said about why the permanent fund was there, why the dividend was set up, et cetera. And so, you know, a lot of those folks have either passed on or moved on. And the reality is that when I read through the history, and I've talked to a number of people, some of whom I served with when I was in the legislature, not at the time that the permanent fund passed, but and the overriding rationale, I think, was an effort to try to save some of a non-renewable resource that could be used in the future in order to provide and change it into a renewable resource. And I know why we're talking about permanent fund earnings as a part of a fiscal plan. I don't believe that there's any responsible fiscal plan that works without earnings of the permanent fund. It's and as far as dividends go and inflation proofing go, dividends are very, very popular. I get that. I think there's a rationale for having a dividend and keeping a dividend as a result of our Constitution, which has the subsurface resources owned by the state in common property. So I think there's a rationale for distributing a dividend, but I don't think it can be the only spending decision that we make with earnings of the permanent fund. Really, this is what I want to talk about most is economic development. There's broad public support for economic development. It provides opportunities for jobs and income and I think is a big part of our future, positive economic impacts for communities and the state. But does it really help our fiscal situation? And this is an economic development plan that we put together. Will economic development save us? Is it good for the Kenai Peninsula? Is it good for Alaska? And before I get to that, I want to just show you a slide about the revenues that the Kenai Peninsula Borough in FY16 got from the state government. These are transfer payments for various uses that come from the state to local governments. When oftentimes when we see reductions at the state level, they look like reductions in the state budget, but they either translate into tax increases at the local level or impacts in those cases where either local decisions are made in order to reduce it. But it's important for us, you know, the PERS and TERS is a huge issue, and I know that you're all well aware of it. Transferring more of those costs to local government, and if you look at the history of that issue, I hope you'll recognize that it's not really fair to keep pushing that onto the local governments, and local governments will have to react, I think, more strongly if additional efforts are made in that direction. And I didn't come here to threaten the legislature. I know where the power lies and where the authority lies. I just want to say that from our perspective as local governments, we're seeing the impact. We've already seen significant transfers from PERS and TERS, and we hope that we won't have to see another shift in that manner. It does increase local taxes. I just put this slide in here because I actually did make up the next scenario. The scenario is purely made up. There's no billion-dollar investment being talked about on the Kenai Peninsula right now, but I wanted to demonstrate what the difference is between local government's ability and the state government's ability to capture some of the revenues from economic development in order to pay the cost of the services. So the assumptions here are that an economic development proposal must be approved by both the state and the borough, and that they must both determine whether or not economic development makes sense for them and make a determination, yes or no. So the proposal is, and the scenario is, a new widget manufacturing plant wants to move to the Kenai Peninsula Borough. It will create 10,000 jobs, bring in 10,000 new families, 5,000 new students to the school district, 10,000 new homes to house the families at an average value of $200,000 per home, $1 billion in capital investment by the Widget Manufacturing of America, LLC, and it's an LLC because LLCs don't pay corporate taxes in Alaska, and I wanted to make sure that I could reflect it in that manner. So with respect to the Kenai Borough decision and new revenues, we get about $5 million a year in additional borough sales taxes. We get $20 million a year in borough and service area property taxes on the homes, and another $10 million a year in borough and service area property taxes on the widget factory's investment. In terms of higher expenses, 5,000 students would be more than a 50% gain over the current school district enrollment. If we use the same formula, state pays two-thirds of the cost of our budget. It's Kenai Peninsula. 50% in increase in the borough is about $27 million additional cost to the Kenai Peninsula borough. So the math for the Kenai borough is that we get $5 million addition in borough sales taxes, $20 million in property taxes, and $10 million additional in property taxes on the investment, and we have costs of $27.5 million. At the end of the day, it ends up as a net $7.5 million net gain to the Kenai Peninsula borough as a result of economic development. So in our case, after spending for education, our decision is a resounding yes. It's a winner. We should do it. It makes good sense for our local economy. With respect to the state of Alaska's decision for new revenues, the state return on economic activity is zero. State has higher expenses in terms of troopers, highways, courts, prisons, all of the things that we do at the state level in this state because of the economies of scales and a broad geographic area and a small population that creates economies of scale that don't apply in other states. So a lot of our services are done at the state level here. And then most importantly is the $45 million in increased school funding costs under the formula program. So for the state of Alaska, the decision just doesn't add up. It's $55 million in additional expenses with zero new revenue. So the decision for the state, if this scenario were true, would be they'd have to make no, because it actually increases the state budget gap by having economic development of this type. And so at the end of the day, the economic development decision would be Kenai Borough, yes, state of Alaska, no. And it's really why we need a broad-based tax. Economic development could make the state's fiscal situation even worse. In order to get the type of investment that we need in Alaska, not just in any economic development, but even in oil and gas development, requires a capital investment. When you leave a gap in the fiscal plan, everybody knows at some point they're going to be asked to contribute it. So whether or not oil and gas, or whether you're talking about somebody else coming in and making some type of investment, at some point they're going to be asked to contribute more. And no wonder it's so difficult. We all bring our own biases, experience, and philosophies to the debate. When multiplied by the governor and his staff, 60 legislators and their staffs, then adding in the population of Alaska, factoring in talk radio, political parties, election dynamics, the media, right and left wing splinter groups, lobbyists, special interests, and a multitude of constituencies, for every item in the budget, the problem just doesn't seem all that difficult. So we've developed a perfect plan. This is it. There isn't one. Everyone wants to go back to the way things were, where we had excess revenues, where we didn't have to pay for our services, although we have been paying taxes at the local level. But we're going to be debating budget levels and priorities forever. We're going to be debating taxes, which types of taxes, how much taxes, who pays them, etc., over a long period of time. And there will be political consequences. But again, in order to get the investment that we want to see, in order to have economic opportunities in Alaska for the foreseeable future, not just for our generations, but for the next generation and the generation after that, we need a fiscal plan that accommodates it. Otherwise, we really set up a false economy. I just put this in here because I'm getting to the end of my presentation. I wanted to soften you up a little before we get to questions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mayor Navarro. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the state's been really generous. Two-thirds of education is being paid by the state. In most other states, that's not true. That's done on a local level. PERS and TERS contributions, we've been taking up the slack even after we put $3 billion in the sources again. Part of that is to make up for the municipalities. Revenue sharing, everybody wants revenue to be shared. We have no revenue. So at what point does the state finally say that we can't pick up the extra shares for the municipalities, and if they want certain services, that it should be their responsibility now to pay for those?
Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that question. With respect to education, I think our Constitution says that the state will provide for education. And part of the way that we have provided for it is that at least for eight of our borough governments, they were formed as part of a mandatory borough act in 1964. So we were forced into contributing it, and now we pay a local share. It's a significant amount of the cost of education, as you're probably as aware as I am. Education and the cost of education are continually going up. It's insatiable. And education is and should be a priority, and whether it's paid for at the state level through taxes at the state level, or if you're going to reduce the state contribution to education and put more on local governments, you have the whole issue of organized versus unorganized, the questions associated with that all of unorganized falls to the state. And the other thing that you have is that under the disparity test and the way that things are structured, you're going to have to make a significant change to the foundation formula program in order to allow local governments some additional flexibility. And so that sets up a whole other set of complexes. With PERS and TERS, I really appreciate that question, because I've dealt with this for years when I was in the legislature, when we looked at what those contribution rates were, and since then when I've been on the municipal side. And it's tough to unravel that. But here's the thing that we look at it from the local governments. The retirement programs were established by the state. And yes, local governments did participate in it. But we relied on the state's actuaries, the state's consultants, to tell us what we were supposed to pay at the time that we were supposed to pay it, just like the state did with their contributions. So local governments contributed what we were asked to pay, what we felt we were supposed to pay, based on a calculation, again, that was done by the state and consultants that were hired by the state. And then when there was an issue with the consultant and the actuary and huge mistakes were made and the state sued, I think it was in excess of $5 billion, which was originally asked for or considered, the state settled that. They settled that without any discussion, without any input, without any information provided by local, either to or from local governments about what those impacts were. We had no say at the table. And ever since then, what we've seen is somehow local governments have created this problem, and it's not. We're in this together, and when you look at the way that the termination studies apply at the state level and the local levels, when the state cuts positions and they stop that whatever contribution is going into the retirement programs, there's no cost to them because it's assumed that the state picks up whatever the difference is. At the local levels, when we eliminate positions, and it's much more difficult for smaller communities, when we eliminate positions, we have to pay in to the system for the next 25 years. I can give you a good example of that, because the last mayor at the Kenai Peninsula Borough was a retired school teacher. They took the mayor's position out of the retirement program. So the last 6 years that I've been mayor, I've not been part of the retirement system. I'm not getting any additional time for in the system, but the Kenai Peninsula Borough is still paying into the retirement system for my position as if I were. That doesn't happen at the state level, and so there's a lot of nuances to how PERS and TERS is being administered, including at the end of the day, if we end up in litigation, and that's a possibility, if we end up in litigation between the state and local governments probably come out on the short end, not because we wouldn't win the litigation, but because at the end of the day, the state has so many other tools they can penalize us with if they choose to do it in that fashion. And so trying to unravel whose share came from what is very, very difficult. I talked to Commissioner Fisher about this, and I also spoke to the governor's office, and the PERS-TERS one is something that is far more complex, I think. It's not simply correct to say that it's a local government responsibility. This was a problem that was created in large part by the state. With respect to revenue sharing, revenue sharing is important, and it's far more important to smaller communities than it is to the bigger communities that have a tax base that can support it. Many of our communities around this state simply do not. The other thing is with revenue sharing, and I showed that slide, we get revenue sharing and we also get this community revenue sharing, which started in 2006. It's a new program. I think it started in 2006 because it wasn't there last time I was mayor and it wasn't there when I was in the legislature. But it's this new program that now unincorporated communities, even within boroughs, but in areas outside incorporated areas also. So we have now, I think, 27 communities within the Kenai Peninsula Borough that get this allocation. And many of them use it for insurance. Many of them use it for their Head Start programs, other types of good community programs. And when that gets jerked out from under them, it's going to create really significant impacts. And that's, I know that you guys have a tough job. And that's why the budget cuts are so much more difficult than they seem at the surface. You know, when I was in the legislature, we traveled around to different communities to talk about where we should cut the budget. And we had slideshows and we had packets that we handed out and on the sense, where would you want to see budget cuts? And of course, everybody said Department of Administration, cut them 80%. You know, administration, there's way too much administration. Then you turn to the next page on administration, it says, do you support senior programs? Do you support the longevity bonus? They said, oh, yeah, that should be the same or more. Those were all programs within a Department of Administration. And so it's really why this forum and our system of government where we elect folks to represent our interests is a system that works. You, all of you, know far more about what's going on in government, how the pieces fit together, than the public as a whole. That's not to say the public's not important. They surely are. But they're never going to have the same level of understanding as you do because of the access to information and discussion and debate that takes place here.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
First of all, I don't think any of it's your fault. So I hope I didn't, you know, insinuate that in any fashion. But the one point you brought up, and it's a question that I think is going to have more conversation, and that was you as a municipality, just so you know, Fairbanks feels your pain. We were part of that. That became a borough that chose, voted not to be that. But do you think we're at a point that that discussion of those who are boroughs or cities basically able to tax and those areas that aren't, what is that conversation, you know, from your position at this point and in your residence, are we there that discussion has to happen because we do have so much of the state that pays local government and we have those that don't before we move any further into, you know, what other efficiencies we start looking at?
You know, that's another very good question. And what the reality is that all local governments are situated differently. You know, it's not one size fits all. Some have sales taxes and no property taxes. Some have property taxes and no sales taxes. Some have a combination of both and other ways that they generate local revenues. Some also have tax caps in place. And it's not that those can't be changed. They can, but oftentimes they're either part of the charter, it requires a public vote, it can't happen immediately. And so when you talk about shifting costs to local governments because they have a tax base, I just caution you that one size doesn't fit all. There's a lot of different impacts that will fall to local governments that will end up manifesting as unanticipated, very negative effects because all of them are situated a little bit differently.
Mr. Chairman,
hello?
My question was for those who don't have a tax base, who have chosen or was not forced into a borough-type entity, you know, I agree with everything you said. I'm glad you brought that up because everybody does have different things that they can do. But do you feel, as a legislature, that there's going to be a time probably in the near future that we have to start talking about, you know, do we have areas that stay unincorporated, that don't give any parts of their shares in the same fashion? Everybody gives something. I mean, there's pipeline areas that the state gets and they don't go to local government. So I don't think there's any place that doesn't pay anything, but there is definitely a disparity between areas. When would that discussion begin as we're looking deeper into the budget and what we're able to spend money on?
Yeah, that's something that we have discussed and debated since we became a state. There are many rural areas of the state that really don't have an economy or really don't have much of a tax base. And that's the problem, is that you're not and shouldn't force them to move into urban areas where they can pay taxes. And even if you set up governments in those areas and try to get something back from them, It's extremely difficult because there simply is no real tax base. And we have some of those issues even within our borough because of tax-exempt status in the village of Tyonek. Because most of the land is owned by the village corporation or the native corporation, it's mostly tax-exempt or it was built with federal grants. And so even though we're providing services over there, we're not getting a lot of contribution back from that community also. But it's the nature of the beast in Alaska is that we have a huge state and economies of scale just don't apply in some areas. So how do you get that? You know, usually when there's a tax force base that's put in place, Red Dog Mine, others, then you see governments, even in the Aleutians where you see the fisheries taxes, then you see governments form in order to accommodate that at the local level.
And Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate allowing the questions, and I don't mean any of those areas you don't have economy, but we do have places in the state that do have revenue who have just chosen not to go to that level because, to be honest, it's more beneficial for the state to be taking care of those needs versus, you know, the local residents. But I think as we get into these discussions on these kinds of bills, the disparity between communities is going to become stronger and stronger, and how we decide to deal with that part of it is I think, one of the next discussions we're going to need to have. Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Mayor, for coming in. It's good to see you. You know, I think you probably know that, you know, I could get votes by just rearranging the chairs on the Titanic and, you know, get a few more elections under me and leave a mess, and I refuse to do that. So I appreciate you coming forward and chiming in that it's that we should take some action. The question was raised, what if we just transfer costs to municipalities, like school costs to municipalities? For those municipalities that don't have a tax cap, that would just be saying, well, we're not going to pay, but we're going to make that. That's just going to raise the cost for local citizens, right? It's not going to put them any further ahead, is it?
Yeah, not really, and even perhaps as importantly, in some of those communities that have oil and gas properties, like in the Kenai Peninsula Borough, we have oil and gas properties. We assess or we tax at about a 10 mil average level. If costs are shifted to the local government, we're going to increase our mill levy. That's going to reduce, in part, at least there, some revenue stream from the state from those oil and gas properties. But I think that whether you pay it at the state level or you pay it at the local level, you're still going to have the economic impacts associated. And so I actually think it's better to do it at the state level rather than try to shift more to local governments and create even more of a disparity about, okay, well, we're paying for ours. Why are rural communities getting it for free?
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And I know you're involved in the business community on the Kenai. So I have a sense that by not solving our fiscal problem and leaving this deficit and not telling people what we're going to do to fix it, it creates a kind of uncertainty that businesses don't like. They don't know what is in store in the future for them. I guess, is there any validity to that, and what's your opinion on that?
Thank you. Absolutely. And I can give you a personal experience. We used to have 9 Radio Shack stores in Alaska. And in part because of internet competition, which, by the way, is one of the things that will affect sales tax revenues. If sales taxes, combination between local and state, gets too high, you'll push even more to internet sales, which are more difficult to collect sales taxes on. So we had 9 Radio Shack stores at one point throughout Alaska, in Ketchikan, in Juneau, in Wasilla, in Fairbanks, Kenai, Soldotna, and we closed them all down. And we did it in part because we were struggling to make it even in a relatively stable economy. And I could see what's coming, and with an economic contraction, it's going to get even worse. And so we closed those down. It was difficult decisions to make, but it was a business decision. We also have Arby's restaurants in Alaska, and we sold some of our property a couple of years ago in Anchorage, and we've been looking for opportunities to invest. And I have siblings who say, you know, we should build another restaurant here, we should invest in this over here, and I'm the head of the company, and I said, no, we're not investing anything right now, because I do my own personal for our company, and have since I started developing and working with the company in about 1989 or 90. I do a kind of a five-year economic outlook, and if I think that we're going to have a relatively stable economy over 5 years, I figure if I can get 5 years into an investment, I probably can ride out an economic downturn. And so I do that economic projection. I have since 1989. This is, since then, this is the worst personal economic outlook I have. I am very concerned, not about government spending, all of those things. There's a forum for that, and it's this legislative body, the House and the Senate. You know, you argue about those things and what levels of spending, what taxes are going to be, etc. But the overall economy is what we really need to be focused on for the short and long term. We can dial back. If we put an income tax in place, we can dial back on it. We've done it before. If revenues are higher from oil and gas than we anticipate, we can make other choices. And really, that speaks to the ability of this body and future legislative bodies to make those types of responsible decisions. The public doesn't always see it that way, but in fact, our system of government does work.
Finally, Mr. Chair.
A follow-up?
Thanks. And then, Mayor, I'm not thrilled with the education policy that some are proposing. Some are proposing a $65-70 million cut to schools on top of the $25-30 million we've had in the last 3 years. Is there anything you can say about how that's been impacting your schools, and how another $65-70 million cut that some are proposing in this building would affect your schools?
Yes, we are just in the process of putting the final touches on our local budgets. We are increasing our local contribution to education. We increased it a few years ago, and we're increasing it again, partly as a result that we don't want to see some of the impacts that we're already seeing, because we're not keeping up with inflation now. And so what it means is impacts to the kids who are in school now. Now, Alaska is going to recover and come out of this. I have no question that our long-term outlook is very good. It's the short term that we really need to fix, or what we do is we do impact educational opportunities for the kids who are in school now. And once they're through, they don't get to go back and do it over. It's another generation that will be coming through. And so keep that in mind. We can't make up that level of cut at the local level. We are only now about $1 million under the cap. We were at the cap for years, and then we dialed back on it after we got a change in the foundation formula program that recognized an area cost differential for the Kenai Peninsula borough. That happened about 2006 or 7 also. And so we dialed back a little bit on it, but now we're almost back up to the cap. And if the state reduces, we don't get to make that decision at the local level, because if we can't contribute enough to make up what the state cuts, and our local contribution is reduced because of the nuances of the foundation program and how much we can contribute locally, so we'll be impacted in two ways.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah. So, Mike, I just wanted to kind of touch a little bit more on what you just highlighted. I mean, there's the decisions of the local communities have also driven some of the cost discussion there. So, in the last 10 years, Alaska has we've seen an increase, but we have about the same number of students that we did in 2007. Inflation and I appreciate, I actually give some make sure that I throw some credit to Representative Wilson, because she was looking into some of this. Inflation over that time frame has been about 17.5%, but yet we have increased our formula funding by 35%. So we've doubled what inflation was. And so But yet we still have conversations from the local communities that come in here and say, you're not giving enough, whether it's not enough, we're going to have to raise to our cap, we can't afford this. There's a conversation that has to, that goes back to the local communities of, if you're not able to afford that, then this is a local challenge that you have lived with beyond the means that you should have. You've gone above inflation, but yet somehow it comes back on us how we've got to solve this problem here. We've got to fix the decisions that are made on those local levels. And I get the constitutional requirement that we've got to fund some of these things, but with the challenge is we don't have actions, and I'm going to include my school district in that as well. Over that time frame, not trying to highlight one specific, you know, person through that time, but we have 2,000 less students than we did in 2007, but yet we've also encouraged that additional cost. So at what point does the state have to step in? And I don't like that, but where is that appropriate line of, you're asking us to fund this, you've doubled the cost of inflation, but every year I get told, you know, we're barely keeping up with inflation, but yet that was not a decision that was necessarily made by the state. Those were decisions that were made on the local level that are driving that cost that now we've got to fund. How do we balance that?
You know, I appreciate that, and I'd say it's twofold. It's partly what changes the state made in the foundation formula program that recognized special needs, and because special needs now is a 13 multiplier, where it used to have 5 or something, it's changed over time. What that shows in the Kenai Peninsula borough is that our overall student population has also gone down, but because of the multiplier for special needs, that the total number that we're compensated for at the state level is higher. And so I think that part of that's the state's change, probably advocated for it by local education officials, but also at the state level. And so that's part of why we're seeing those increases, and why the other part is that like on the Kenai Peninsula, if we lose 100 students, it seems like we could cut a few teachers. The problem is that we have 42 schools that we're operating out of. And so if you lose one or two from each school, you still get to that number, but it doesn't translate into a reduction in staff overall. And so that's part of the problems. One of the things that, and I'm going to get beat up for this, but that's okay. he's here to protect me. You know, one of the things is that you know, and I support the labor organizations, okay? But what we see oftentimes is better of. One community negotiates something in their agreement, and then if it's successful, it's translated over to another district or community, and you see the better of, and that results in a overall creep in costs and expenses. Now, having said that, I think a lot of times our priorities are messed up. If we look at what we pay for health care, and then we look at what we pay for teachers, you know, teachers are mind doctors. You know, that I think that they should be compensated more. It's just that it's difficult to get there, particularly without some sort of a real economic base, which means broad-based taxes.
Follow up. Yeah, thanks, Mike, and I appreciate it. Of course, you've got a unique perspective of having the business owner being down here, being a leader down here, and of course, and then moving back to your local communities. One of the things that what you highlighted there is kind of stood out, and I want to use your perspective, and Anchorage is different, so I'm going to use Anchorage, and that might not necessarily apply to Kenai Peninsula or even some of the other districts. You know, a previous superintendent, not the particular one, I remember having a conversation with that superintendent, asking them about thought processes in terms of utilization of schools. And I know you guys have changed some of your utilization over the last few years. Skyview, for example, is utilized different than it was. But I said, I know that some of the schools in my community, as much as I don't want to shut down local community schools, I know they're being underutilized. Now, there was one at 60%. There was another one that was in the in the 70%, there was one right outside of my district that was even down in the 50%. And I said, if these are numbers that are trending throughout the city, this is just one area of the city, there's maybe an opportunity where the consolidation could take place. And I remember it looked at me and just said, well, no. I mean, I'm quickly paraphrasing it. He tried to do it in a manner that sounded political, but he didn't know what he was talking about. And he just said, no, we're not going to do that. And that's where that conversation about, you know, and no one wants to just eliminate teachers, but that consolidation and efficiencies that can take place in that local area, that's that challenge that then we have to somehow, we're going to go ahead and continue to fund a fully operational school at 60% capacity because of the fact that there's not a desire to change. And the truth is there's got to be an effort, and we got to, it's on the state level. I don't want to cast shade and say that the local levels are at fault, because this is on every level. But we're going to have to do things different. And I guess that as if we go forward, not just yourself, but all the local communities, I think to give some help for us as we go back to our communities, because you're talking about broad-based, you're talking about looking at, we've got to be able to have a conversation that everyone's being smart with their money. And those kinds of things, and that kind of conversation in my office would just know we're not going to be efficient. That doesn't give me that comfort to be able to go back and say, yep, it's the right thing. We're going to need to start taking more money from your pocket to be paying for these types of things. And so I would, you know, that's obviously not you, but that's just an example of some of the challenges. And I would hope that there could be additional conversations on the local levels amongst peers how to address that.
I greatly appreciate that. I think there's nothing that local governments would like better than to be more a part of the conversation. It seems like we're always playing defense on different types of reductions from the state level or cost shifts from the state level. And that's really not the intent, but we have a responsibility, too, to our constituencies and to how we're dealing with things at the local level in order to say, wait a minute, this is going to have consequences for us, and here's why. And so you're right. It needs to change. Things need to change over time. I'll give you another example. I may get in trouble for this one too, but that's okay. In the Kenai Peninsula Borough, we have pupil transportation, and the state's paying 100% of pupil transportation. Well, as a result of that, in the Kenai-Soldotna area, they have one set of buses and they run two routes. They have staggered start times, staggered finish times, and it saves money. In Homer, because it started a long time ago, but in Homer, they have two sets of buses, and they run at the same time. And that's because in Homer, that's what they've gotten used to. They wanted to have their kids go to school and get out at the same time so that they don't have latchkey kids and older kids can take care of younger kids, whatever, for the convenience. And so when I became mayor again in 2011, I started talking to the school district about changing that. I said, look, there's a cost savings that can be achieved. And the response I got at the time was that, well, it doesn't cost us anything. I said, yeah, but it costs the state. And so now, and Representative Seaton can attest to this now, they've changed the route. And so, and it's saving them, I think, almost maybe a little over $500,000 a year, which means it will save the state $500,000 a year. And so, again, all communities are a little different, but there are some efficiencies that we're working towards and trying to achieve that will also save the state funding.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Please have amendments for HB 115 turned into my aide, Jane Pearson, by 4 p.m. on Friday, March 31st. And our next House Finance Committee meeting will be held today, Tuesday, March 28th at 1:30 p.m., and we'll continue our hearing on HB 115 with Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division. And with that, we will be adjourned at 11:08 a.m.